You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber. On tonight's program, I talk with Carol Dines at the top of the hour about her latest young adult novel, The Takeover Friend. On the second day of ninth grade, introverted Frances meets Sonia, a wildly funny newcomer from France, and the girls form a fast friendship. But respective family crises begin to escalate, and tensions come to a head when Sonia temporarily moves in with Frances' family. It forces each friend to decide how close is too close. Both funny and poignant, The Takeover Friend is a smart page-turner that focuses on the importance of finding your own voice in relationships.
Then, in the last part of the hour, Liz Olds chats with Christine Wells about her upcoming novel, One Woman's War, a novel of the real Miss Moneypenny. One of BookBub's best historical fiction books of fall, it's the story of a World War II British naval intelligence officer who served as the real-life inspiration for the James Bond character Miss Moneypenny, whose international covert operation is put in jeopardy when a volatile socialite and Austrian double agent threatens to expose the mission to German high command. All of this and more, so stay tuned to Right on Radio.
Hello, Carol, can you hear me?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. One second. All right. Hi, Carol. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for having me on tonight.
Well, it's great to have you on the show. Do you have your reading ready?
I do.
All right. Why don't you go ahead?
Can I set it up a little bit, or should I just go ahead and read?
Why don't you preface it? Yeah, talk a little bit about what you're going to read.
Okay. So this is a chapter that is about a third of the way into the book. And Sonia and Frances have become best friends. Sonia is away for the holidays, coming back to spend New Year's Eve with Frances's family. And Frances's father, who suffers from bipolar disorder, is beginning to have he's in a manic phase, and it's beginning to impact the family. So this is Christmas Eve. On Christmas Eve, we always invited Mom's cousins, JJ and Kirsten, and their six-year-old son, Leif, who adored Will. They dressed alike, turtlenecks, hand-knit sweaters, khakis, and merrells. JJ was 10 years younger than Mom, but he looked just like her, tall, blonde, blue-eyed. Kirsten was tiny, with hair the color of clothespins and a long face. They had both become religious after they met in treatment years before, and now they were both counselors for drug-addicted teenagers. At one point, Kirsten was describing the opioid problem in Hinckley, where they lived, an hour north of Minneapolis. "We see a lot more burglaries now, and it's mostly drug-related. People are desperate," she said. Leif was a small boy with wide ears, gray eyes, and short cropped blonde hair. As his mother talked, he unconsciously lowered his hand to his crotch. "Do you need to use the bathroom?" Kirsten asked him. Leif shook his head, but he kept scratching. Kirsten grew stern. "Then leave your little man alone." "That's his penis," Dad said. Leif burst into giggles. "You're not supposed to use that word." "Penis?" Dad looked at Kirsten. "Is there something in the Bible against using the word penis?" "I think not." He turned back to Leif. "I use penis all the time. In fact," Dad grinned, "it's a wonderful penis Christmas, isn't it?" Allie glared at Mom. "Why do you let him do this?" "What?" Dad laughed. "Start a penis conversation?" Kirsten reached over and put her hand on Leif's arm. "Uncle William is just being silly." "Silly penis me," Dad whispered to Leif. "Penis Uncle William," Leif giggled uncontrollably. "Penis presents, penis napkins, penis everything." I laughed. Will laughed. Even JJ smiled. Kirsten, Mom, and Allie glared at Dad. Very soon, Kirsten, JJ, and Leaf left, and we all helped Mom clear and stack the dishes in the dishwasher. Dad went outside to walk the dogs. No one said a word until Mom held a dish towel to her face. Go upstairs, please, all of you. She didn't want us to see her crying. Allie hugged her until Mom gently pushed her back. Go. I need to talk to your father when he comes inside. I went upstairs and got into bed. We were a different family now. We listened harder, stared harder, but spoke our truths less. I wondered if we'd always been this way, so separate, or now that I was older, I was seeing the truth of my family for the first time, pieces instead of a whole. In my mind, I tried to draw a line around us. I tried to hold us all inside the line, but more and more, I felt the line had been broken. And instead of a circle, we were dots scattered separately. I heard a scratch on my door, and when I opened it, Vinny jumped on my bed. I lay awake, feeling his breath on my ankle. I wondered if he could smell the future, if he knew why the silences inside our family had turned so heavy. On Christmas Day, Mom wasn't speaking to Dad. Usually we'd go ice skating on Lake of the Isles, all of us together. But this year, it didn't feel like a holiday. It didn't feel like anything special. We opened gifts and drank coffee, nibbling the cranberry orange coffee cake Mom had baked. Afterward, we thanked each other and disappeared into our separate rooms. I stayed in my room much of the day, waiting for Sonia to call. And when she did, I blurted, "You sent a card to Gravy and signed my name." Dr. Jack Gravy is the boy she has a crush on. Mm-hmm. "Life doesn't just happen," Sonia said. "You've got to make it happen." "And you didn't tell me that my dad gave you a book," I told her. "I asked to borrow it and he gave it to me instead. What's the big deal?" "No big deal." The truth was I missed her too much to argue. She told me Aunt Tessa is all over this dentist, Robert Jackal. She has the worst taste in men. His teeth match his tennis shoes. Too white, you know? "Like Mr. Ellsworth, our principal," I said. "Those are faux teeth," Sonia said. "Way too big for his mouth. He can barely get his lips over. I think he bought them from a horse breeder. Betty takes them out at night and puts them in a glass of bleach." "A bucket, you mean," she laughed. I lay back laughing. Never underestimate laughter.
Very good. That was Carol Dines reading from her new young adult novel, The Takeover Friend. Dines has published three previous young adult books, including two novels, Best Friends Tell the Best Lies, The Queen Soprano, as well as a collection of short stories, Talk to Me, and a collection of short stories for adults that we talked about on Rhino Radio, This Distance We Called Love. She's a recipient of the Judy Bloom Award, as well as a recipient of Minnesota and Wisconsin State Artist Fellowships. She has taught writing to all ages at universities, colleges, and public schools in Colorado, Florida, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. Carol, welcome back to Write on Radio.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
This book, it opens with a sweet interchange between the characters Francis and Sonia. You reveal that Francis is a weirdo magnet. And I like this because it's something that I can relate to and I've had experiences in my own life. And it's a small detail that as a reader, we can extrapolate from this how this person's going to act in the book. My first question is a two-parter. When you drew up these characters in your mind, did parts of the personality manifest then? Was this something that you discovered during the writing process?
Francis is very much like my adolescent self. So I started this book wanting to write about a friendship that gets very enmeshed. Because I think it happens often during adolescence. It can happen any time in our lives. But I think young people want so much to cross boundaries and get close, and they don't understand the idea of having healthy boundaries. In fact, they equate no boundaries with really a close friendship. So I wanted to write about a friendship at that age that gets so close they sort of suffocate each other in a way. It's very hard for them to grow separately. And Francis came first and Sonia arrived very quickly. I can't really remember the seeds of Sonia, except I felt like I have known a Sonia or two in my life.
So my second part to that question was ask you who you saw yourself in. So that answers that. But it was funny for me because initially I responded to Frances and I could see where the weirdness of people drawn to her, and she comes across very open and a very like a natural empath. Mm-hmm. But however, then we go into Sonia and she gives these gruesome details, I think, in the first chapter of her head exploding, her glasses being intact. And I was like, well, that's something I think a ninth grade version of myself would probably say. So that's a little too much for the public to know about me, but I fell in love with her character right away. So how much fun was it to come up with Sonia's character and to write her pieces in the book?
Sonia was easy for me. I feel that I have always attracted people who are larger than life in a way into my life. And maybe it's because they do represent some part of me that I find harder to access. Sonia is brave. She's brilliant. She's funny. She's not afraid to say exactly what's on her mind. She doesn't overthink anything. And at least at the beginning, I think as the story goes, a lot of that outward electricity in her personality is also bravado that covers up a lot of loneliness and a very chaotic home life. And so that gradually comes to this, as friends get closer, those layers come off. And Sonia's bravado and kind of courageous spirit, I would say, begins to dissipate a little as she becomes more vulnerable. And Frances, on the other hand, begins to find her voice and become stronger. And I really wanted that transformation in both of them.
No, I totally agree. She's probing, she's inquisitive, yet we all, as a reader, we see beneath her charming, meanish exterior, she's a troubled, vulnerable person. And I reveal that, I think, incrementally throughout the book. I was going through the book, and lo and behold, there's a character in this book whose name is Josh. He's gawky, he's geeky, he's glad to help people, and has a tendency to drag out a joke way past the expiration date. What the hell, Carol? Were you stalking me? What's going on?
Funny. Oh, I love Josh. Josh is great.
I like Josh too for obvious reasons, but
Josh has a lot of inner strength and perception, and he finally forces Frances to face some of her, you know, her inabilities to be frank with herself. So I think Josh is one of those late bloomers. He's like, I think it comes out in the book where Francis's mother adores Josh. And one of the things I love is that, you know, he was a friend. He wasn't somebody, she has a crush on an older boy, her brother's best friend, but Josh really adores her and is a truly good friend. And I, in my life, have fallen in love with a good friend. And I wanted that to be in the story, that, you know, their friendship does evolve into a deeper romantic relationship.
In chapter 3, we're introduced to Ms. Riva, who takes a firm approach towards the destruction of, she doesn't like people who use different terms within the English language improperly, like with likes and you knows and whatevers and yeahs. Mm-hmm. As a mm-hmm. teacher of reading and writing yourself, were you strict on using proper grammar in conversation with your students?
No.
No.
I think there are teachers who are still, this is a very delicate question because we have such diverse student bodies. And I think what I have made some shifts in my teaching, which is when you have people, I actually don't teach anymore, but when I did teach, I had students for whom English was a second language. And I couldn't expect them, because I've lived in other countries, I know how hard it is to understand the verb tenses and all of that. And people come from different educational backgrounds and different educational opportunities. So in a lot of, in my composition courses, I did teach very functional grammar. I did insist on, you know, I didn't want slang in writing, but in creative writing classes, I want to hear those voices. And so I really wanted students to feel free to write in their own voices. And often that meant not writing in our standard English grammar. And there's a lot of debates over whether we should even be teaching standard English grammar. But I did have, and my daughter, I remember in high school, had a teacher who was a real stickler on it. And she happened to be Indian, as Miss Riva is, Indian American, and but also came from Europe. So maybe subconsciously I was basing this teacher on her. She was a fantastic teacher, and she insisted on proper grammar and theory, and she really drove them, and they learned a lot.
What I especially liked about your handling of Sonia and Francis was, despite their age, they're both intelligent, and you respect the kids and their intelligence, even in ninth grade, in a way that they can be cogent in their reasoning, but insightful about what's happening around them in a way that's appropriate for their age. Did you find this challenging to write? To find that balance?
No, I didn't, because I've been around enough teenagers who kind of blow me away with their knowledge about the world. And about, I've known many teenagers who actually had outgrown high school before they got there. I feel a little bit that way about my daughter, and I feel a little bit about that way about Sonia. Frances is excited about high school and all the activities, but Sonia is really ready for a bigger, a bigger environment. And she's lived all over the world. And so part of it is her insecurity, I think. She wants her big dreams to be reflected in her surroundings. But part of it too is, I think, there are kids who don't identify with the typical high school clubs and social life. And I wanted to show kids, and which I think Sonia and Francis do, where they transform the homecoming float into a poetry mobile. And that enables them to sort of create their own visibility at the school and to kind of find a new identity for themselves.
I think part of their wisdom is thrust upon these kids due to their familial situations. Did you do any research on children who grew up in households with bipolar parents who went through manic episodes?
I didn't need to do research.
Oh boy.
I actually lived, my sister, who is now deceased, had bipolar disorder and suffered greatly from it. She cycled through mania and depression pretty much her whole life. And part of what really inspired this story, originally in the book, the father was going to have vascular dementia. But a few years ago, my husband was put on a pain medication. And unbeknownst to us, it could cause medical mania and medically induced mania. And we didn't know that. And we lived with it for 6 months. And it was like living with somebody I didn't recognize. So I don't think he'd mind my saying it, because he has no memory of it, which is so typical of medically induced mania. When people go through it, if it's a kind of medical, and this was a pain medicine, so who knew? But when we finally got to the neurologist and he got him off of it, within a week, he was back to himself. But it was a very frightening experience. And I felt I could write the father. I love the father. I think the father is a very likable person. I didn't want to make him odd or dislikable. I think he's very understanding and a good father, but he does suffer from a mental illness.
What's interesting about Francis's father is that he sort of fits very well with this artist stereotype. He stresses authenticity. He doesn't like groupthink. He's against the idea of branding yourself to gain visibility instead of having real life experiences. On the other hand, you have Sonia, who holds this opposite approach when it comes to attention. She craves being seen and shamelessly wants to leave her footprint in the world. And what I like is, on one hand, you have a character who wants to preserve their own voice by isolating themselves at the cost of not getting their talent recognized, and then another who wants recognition to avoid being visible to herself and not be like her mother. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think there's so much in young people's lives through social media and through our lives have become so visual. And I think this idea of branding, finding your brand and creating your identity outwardly instead of cultivating a sense of groundedness inside. There's so much outward looking in teenagers' lives today. And I've seen this a lot in my own family and in the students I used to teach. And I think it really is creating a lot of young people who, I mean, part of it is they've only grown up with social media. Mm-hmm. So the father can remember a time when creativity existed just to be creative and the process was what mattered. And I think there's so much more joy in creativity and in our lives when we're looking inward and developing ourselves inwardly, and then and not basing our self-worth and our understanding of ourselves on the images and the brands around us and the way it's outwardly being shown. I'm not being very articulate about that, but I feel this very deeply. And the father is wiser and older, and he's had his day in the sun, or he's had his brief moment of fame, but he understands that the writing and the music are what's really important. And I think this reflects how I feel. I mean, just writing this book, I've had two books in the last 2 years. Before that, there was a long span of time, and it is a different world now. Trying to get both books out there, trying to enter this social media world, it's kind of overwhelming. And I do think there's so much that it's kind of hard for people to even find an identity within it. So I've had my own experience with it these past 2 years. And I must say, it's the writing that gives me joy. Not trying to get out there and brand my books and do all of that. Does that make sense?
It does. I think we actually spent an entire hour talking about that, but we are running out of time here, and I have a lot more questions for you, but I have one big one, and you're going to have to maybe give me a 2-minute response to this. So Okay. Something I noticed is a recurring theme in this book. I mean, you talk a lot about how language and poetry is a means of trying to find your inner voice. But the one thing that happens a lot in this book, though, is this theme of silence. Francis uses silence as a weapon when Sonia has offended her. Her mother uses this against her father. Sonia even comments at a point to Francis that silence can be a way of holding power. In a very fitting way, this is how you end the novel. I don't want to give anything away to the listeners, but that's how it happens. The character finds a way of extinguishing the light of another person in her life. And I want to ask you, was that intentional, this way of bringing silence into her life, is a way of, I guess, speaking in her own way?
Yes, I do think silence was important to me, because Again, there's so much noise in our lives. And for young people in particular, their brains are so wired towards distraction. And one of the things I really loved about Frances, she uses silence as a defense mechanism to protect her. When she doesn't say things to Sonia, it keeps her feelings in her own domain rather than putting them in the domain of the friendship. But it's also for her, she's very thoughtful. She spends time with her feelings before she voices them. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's wise. I think that's her strength. And at the end, I did end it with silence because I think that it's also a sign of being strong, not to fill up her life with noise or with a friendship that isn't necessarily giving her what she needs.
This has been my time talking with Carol Dines about her new book, The Takeover Friend. It is published from Fitzroy Books, and I believe it's released today. Is that right, Carol?
Yes.
All right.
Thank you for having me on. It's always great to talk with you, Josh. It's
great to talk with you. And then, yeah, so Carol, I think you have an event coming up in Majors of Quinn later this week. What else?
Yes, on Thursday, a launch party at Majors and Quinn. People have to register. And October 12th at Red Balloon. And I'll be with Gary Eldon Peter, who's a terrific writer. And on the 20th, a virtual reading through Tattered Cover with a teen psychologist who did her dissertation on teen friendship. Ooh. And so excited about all three. You can find them on my website, www.caroldines.com.
Please, everyone, look forward to that. Carol, thanks so much again for being on the show.
Thanks, Josh. Take care.
And now this. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Josh. Are we ready to go here?
Yes, you're both ready to go.
We are speaking with Christine Wells here on Write on Radio. Welcome to Write on Radio, Christine.
Hi, Liz. Great to be here.
Great. Author of One Woman's War, which I believe is coming out next Tuesday. Is that the release date still?
Yes, that's right.
That must be very exciting. And I believe it is 10:30 on Wednesday morning down there, right?
Yes, down here in Australia.
Down there in Australia where it is spring and we envy you. Why don't you start with the reading that we asked you to prepare?
Oh, I'd love to. Just a little bit of background about the reading. It's about when my heroine, Patty Bennett, is working at room 39 of the Admiralty during World War II. She is working for Ian Fleming, who turns out later to be the author of the James Bond novels. So hence the title, One Woman's War, a novel of the real Miss Moneypenny. Commander Fleming leaned over to place on her desk a 51-item memorandum covered in comments and corrections. Retype that, will you, Miss Bennett, and bring it in when you're finished. Certainly, sir. Her typing skills had improved markedly since her first day in room 39. She lowered her eyes to the page, then looked up at Fleming. The Trout memorandum, sir? One corner of his mouth lifted. We're going to do a spot of fishing. She watched Fleming saunter into Godfrey's lair, then lowered her gaze to the document he handed her. Fleming possessed a brisk, energetic style of prose, direct and to the point. Well, he'd been a journalist at one stage, hadn't he? She seemed to recall her mother mentioning it. Edith had been full of the Flemings and their doings since Patty had taken the job at the Admiralty. Scanning the memorandum, Patty raised her eyebrows and let out a silent whistle. This was by far the most fascinating piece of business she had come across since her arrival. A list of possible operations naval intelligence might carry out, each more outlandish and daring than the last, to deceive, misdirect, sabotage, and otherwise confound the Nazis. Patty suppressed a snort. Someone had clearly grown up on a strict diet of Kipling and Biggles books, Her hand flew to her mouth when she came across one that even Fleming commented was not very nice. The dead body of an airman with pockets full of top secret dispatches to be dropped off somewhere along the Spanish coast for the Germans to find. This idea was one he had filched directly from fiction. She'd read The Milliner's Hat Mystery by Basil Thomson, so she recognized the highly improbable ruse. Of course, the dispatches would be falsified, designed to mislead the Germans about troop movements, invasion strategies, and so on. Surely Godfrey wouldn't entertain such fanciful plots for an instant. But when she gained admittance to the Rear Admiral's office with the retyped memorandum, she realized her mistake. Godfrey took the pages she handed him and frowned over them with fierce concentration. A short bark, which she interpreted as laughter, escaped him at one point. Which item had he found so amusing? It was hard to tell. They'd all been quite extraordinary. Well, Godfrey slapped the memorandum with the back of his hand. Which of these has legs? What do you think, Miss Bennet? Paddy decided to tell the unvarnished truth. I think they are all completely outlandish, sir. Ha! He cocked an eyebrow at Fleming. What do you say to that? They are imaginative, certainly, said Fleming, apparently unperturbed by her challenge. But the more you think about them, the less impossible they appear. Paddy had to be impressed. In Fleming's position, many men would have dismissed or belittled her for stating an opinion at all, much less disagreeing with him. She had to award him points for doing neither. It emboldened her to counter dryly, "They seem to me to be possible only between the covers of a novel." Fleming smiled. "Well, of course, these are all in the order of romantic daydreams, but they contain the germs of very workable plots."
That was a reading from the book One Woman's War by Christine Wells. I would like to start with you talking in your bio. You talk about your father, your relationship with your father, and how he would tell you about kings and queens and nursery rhymes. And I'm wondering if you got a love of history from him and if you would talk a little bit about that.
Oh, yes, definitely. In fact, the other day I was asked what my interest in World War II was all about and when had it started. And when I was about 12, we had a big project to do for school. And it was a 6-month project. And I did mine on the rise and fall of Adolf Hitler. And my father, who he is a keen historian, he studied it at university, but he actually writes books about cricket and rugby history. He taught me how to research and how to use all the different sources and synthesize them all. And, you know, I spent an awful lot of time on this project, and then I lost half a mark for the appearance of it because it wasn't pretty enough. but it was a great learning experience for me.
And what brought you to writing books containing specifically strong women characters?
Ever since I can remember, they've been the sort of characters I've loved to read about. And from Queen Elizabeth I, I had a complete obsession with her for a while. And then all of the amazing women who were dropped behind enemy lines in World War II and had to really live on their wits in occupied France. There are just so many women's stories that aren't widely known today, and it's a real pleasure and privilege to uncover those stories and make them more widely known.
Well, let's talk a little bit about research. I was going to save that for later, but let's talk about it now since we're on that path. You say that COVID or the pandemic made research much more difficult for you for this book. How do you usually do your research, and kind of what stopped you in the pandemic?
It was really being on the spot, because being in Australia, we had to stay here. and although I've been to England several times, I have not been to Portugal, where part of the book is set. A dear friend or author friend of mine, Madeline Martin, sent me photographs of her trip that she made after I had handed this book in. So that was for her book, The Librarian Spy, which was very helpful, but it's not like being there. So that's really what stopped me with the pandemic. And, you know, there are archives and things that you just cannot get access to online. So, yeah, that was a shame.
Talk about the two characters of Patty and, is it Friedel? Is that how you pronounce it?
Yes, Friedel, yeah.
Patty and Friedel, your structure is to go back and forth between one character and the other. Very interesting stories, both of them. And I'm curious why you picked that structure and how the two of them are related to each other.
Well, the challenge I had with Patty's story, Patty becomes involved in Operation Mincemeat, which I described in the excerpt that I read. And the challenge I had with that story, and it was one that the filmmakers who recently made the film of Operation Mincemeat had as well, is that once they've prepared the body and sent it off, there's no antagonist on the spot in London to make trouble for them. All of the action and the conflict happens off stage, as it were, from that point on. So I wanted to have somebody on the spot who could be an antagonist for Patty. And so I had read about Friedel before, because I'd been researching women who were employed as agent provocateurs for MI5 in the wartime. So they would do all sorts of things, but one of the things that Friedel did was monitor fifth column activity among Nazi sympathizers, and she was instrumental in securing the conviction of a Russian emigre who was actually passing American diplomatic information along to the Germans via Italy. So she was engaged in this kind of thing. And then she had an affair with Dushko Popov, who is a bit of an inspiration for the real for James Bond. And he was operating in the Iberian Peninsula around Spain and around where some of the action, where the dead body was found, where that was taking place. And he actually reported back on the Germans' reception of this ploy, I suppose. So it all seemed like it might connect. And so I wanted to start off with Friedel doing her thing with the fifth column, but then becoming involved in Operation Mincemeat a little bit later on, because she actually had been recruited by the Germans first. And that was why British intelligence was interested in her, because they wanted her to pass on information, misinformation, to her German handlers.
What was room 39?
Room 39 is the name of the room at the Admiralty Building where the Directorate of Naval Intelligence worked. So Patty was there with seven officers and she had to work for all of them, including Commander Ian Fleming.
I wanted to ask you about Ian Fleming. What did he do in the real war? Is what you wrote in the book kind of equal to what he did, or did he do less, or did he do more? What was his role?
Everything that he does in the book is true. So he was responsible pretty much single-handedly for evacuating the British refugees from Bordeaux in France after the Germans marched into Paris. He organized a lot of private ships to take those passenger, and some of them were quite reluctant because obviously France wasn't actually firmly on Britain's side at that point, and Britain had to scuttle the French Navy because they couldn't get a commitment from them to turn it over to them. So he did that, and then he worked, but that was while he was working as personal assistant to the Director of Naval Intelligence. So he was everywhere. He was coordinating operations liaising between the Admiral Godfrey and the rest of the different committees who were overseeing all of the intelligence operations of the war. And he ended up forming his own commando group because what he saw was that they didn't have intelligence commandos who could go in quickly to officer the head office of the Germans, wherever that might be, and secure all the documents and the intelligence information that would be really invaluable. And the Germans had done that on Crete when they just surprised the British and launched this big attack. And he saw that that was needed. So he was later went to Canada and he oversaw the training of these commandos. But it's thought that he secretly probably wanted to do all of that sort of work himself. But because he had so much knowledge in his head, he was too valuable to risk in any kind of combat.
Let's talk a little bit about the James Bond novel, since we are talking some about the author. When did you discover Ian Fleming and James Bond? How old were you and so on?
You sound like you know this story, because it is a story. I was 7 when I first saw my first James Bond movie. That was For Your Eyes Only, so I'm probably dating myself, but... my father was a barrister and he had gone down to work in the High Court. He was sitting in Sydney at the time. I live in Brisbane, which is north of there. So Mum took me and my brother down to Sydney and had been entertaining us all week while Dad was in court. And when he got out, she said, right, they're yours and you can entertain them. I'm going shopping. And poor Dad, he was pretty tired. So he took us to James Bond. And Mum was horrified because she thought we were going to museums or something. Oh. And it turned out to be. But I think, you know, I used to go away to my cousin's house. They had a house by the lake. And the only books they had were Neville Shute and Ian Fleming, James Bond. So I read them all because I was such a bookworm. I always ran out of books if I was away from the library for too long. So I read them all then as well. So yeah, it's been a long-standing association.
Yeah, my first James Bond movie was Goldfinger, and my dad took me to it at a drive-in movie theater. So
yes. Well, that's a good one.
Your novel is subtitled A Novel of the Real Miss Moneypenny. Now, our younger listeners may not be familiar with the books, especially. I know the movies are popular, but with the books. And I'm wondering if you could talk about Miss Moneypenny, who she is in the books. And I can't remember if she appears in any of the movies or not. So if you would give us a story about Miss Moneypenny, that would be great.
Well, Miss Moneypenny did appear in several of the movies. She was actually the private secretary to M in the books, who was the head of the MI6, I guess. It was the Secret Service. And basically, she would not be in it very much. I mean, she just, she would see Bond and flirt with him a bit before he went in to see the big man, basically, but she might give him a bit of information about the background and so forth. So she really, these days, she's been given a much bigger role as a former operative. There's been a whole new backstory written for her. And in one of the Bond movies, she actually is tasked with bumping him off and fails. but that's not in the books. That's completely a new tack that the movies take.
Talk about your other books. Again, the female protagonists and the what time periods do they take place? It sounds like you're very interested in World War II. Are some of them before or after? Talk about your other books.
Yes, well, the Sisters of the Resistance is obviously set in the resistance in France during World War II. And that was about Catherine Dior, who was the sister of the famous fashion designer Christian Dior. It's not actually from her point of view, it's from the point of view of two sisters she recruits into helping with her resistance network. So in real life, Catherine Dior was a resistance courier, and she was captured and tortured and sent to Ravensbrück, but she survived and she came back and had a long and happy life growing flowers in the south of France. So that was a lovely ending to a very harsh reality of the time. So that was an amazing book to write, and there wasn't much information about her. That's the reason I didn't make her a point of view character, because I really wanted to stick to exactly what she had done and not embellish that too much, because I felt that just so much respect for what she'd done. I felt that it was right not to make her the point of view character of that story. And another one that isn't set in World War II was The Wife's Tale. And that's about an 18th century court case. So I used to be a lawyer many years ago, so I was very interested in this action. It was criminal conversation. So what that was a husband could sue his wife's lover for damages because the wife was his chattel and the lover had damaged the goods. So being a bit of a feminist, I was outraged by this. And I discovered so many similar cases to the one that I was actually looking at. And there was a really fascinating one where a writer, Caroline Norton, who was having an affair, she actually did have an affair with Lord Melbourne, who ended up being Queen Victoria's Prime Minister. And her husband, politically motivated partly, sued Lord Melbourne for criminal conversation. But not only did he do that, he abandoned her and took her children away and took her royalties from her book, because everything she earned, and she was the main breadwinner, everything she earned was his because he was her husband. So I just found that so outrageous. I had to write a story where the woman won. So that's The Wife's Tale.
It sounds like the woman wins in your books. That's part of the whole idea. We have been speaking with Christine Wells, author of One Woman's War, a novel of the real Miss Moneypenny. We just have a few minutes left. Why don't you let us know what's next? What's on the docket?
Oh, on the docket. I've just handed in a book that is tentatively titled, a bit of a mouthful, The Royal Windsor Orphan. And it is about a girl who grows up at Shepherd's Hotel in Cairo pre-war. And she discovers or is told that she is the illegitimate daughter of Edward VIII, who ended up abdicating the throne and becoming the Duke of Windsor, and a French courtesan who was infamous for doing a very shocking thing. So that was a little bit of a departure, and it does cover the war years, but it's not about the war. It's very much a personal story about her discovering who she is.
Speaking of history, we just recently lost Queen Elizabeth II, and I'm wondering what effect is it having in Australia?
I think no matter what you believe about the monarchy, and many Australians are Republicans, there's no doubt that she was beloved and respected by all. We were all very sad, and I still tear up a bit now thinking of it. It's had a big impact, I think, and we had a national day of mourning for her. So, and actually it's in my state, it's the Queen's birthday holiday on Monday. So she's very important to us, and you know, may she rest in peace. She was an amazing woman.
I agree. Thank you so much. Thank you, Christine Wells. Again, One Woman's War is going to be released next Tuesday, October 4th. Is it being released up here in the United States as well as Australia, or can people find it?
Yes, that's right. It's United States first, yes.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much. Happy spring. And we appreciate you being with us on Right on Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Me too. Okay, take care. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
You're listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Josh Weber. I'd like to thank our special guests tonight, Carol Dines and Christine Wells, and all of our listeners. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and info about Right on Radio at kfai.org/rightonradio. You can listen to all of our favorite Right on Radio episodes on Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and so on. Please stay tuned for Bonjour, Minnesota. Thank you.